Good morning, everybody. We're starting the second day of our ASAF meeting. The first topic on our agenda this morning is business combinations, post-implementation review. I give the floor to Mariella for some introductory words.
Thank you. Thank you, Hans. All right. Thank you, Hans. Good morning, everyone. The purpose of this meeting is to gather your input on the work that we are doing on the post-implementation review of IFRS 3 business combinations, and more specifically, your feedback on the areas that we have identified during this first phase as being the areas that pose the most challenges to entities applying the standard, and also your specific feedback or input in the suggested set of questions that we have put together in Agenda Paper 5B. As you know, we started the discussions on the post-implementation review with the board back in July, and at that board meeting, the board tentatively agreed what was going to be the scope of the review and the activities that the staff was going to be undertaking during the following months of the first phase of the review. And since then, we have outreach and gather input from users, preparers, accounting firms, national standard setters, evaluation specialists, regulators. We have also talked to organizations in-house, such as the Interpretations Committee and the Advisory Council. And what we have gathered so far is summarized and compiled in Agenda Paper 5A. And this agenda paper is actually the one that we presented to the board in November. It's identical. And this paper identifies the issues into two broad categories: matters that deal with the usefulness of information from the standard, and matters that deals with practical implementation issues. And as you might have noticed already, this is indeed the two main areas where we have tried to focus the questions as well. So for all of those areas identified to be relevant, what we have tried to do in paper 5B is to put questions that deal with these two matters, questions that deal with the usefulness of information provided by the standard, and questions that deal with the implementation challenges or issues. So if I go back to this paper 5A, what we've done there is, apart from classifying those issues into these two broad categories, we have assigned a degree of relevance to help us identify what was going to be the areas that we wanted to include in the request for information. And the request for information, the questions that we have put together are the ones that have been assigned with a degree of relevance of high. And paper 5B is a very similar paper. You have a revised version, but it's a very similar paper to the one that we presented to the board in November. Paper 5B is the one that we will present to the board next week for final additional input. And this is actually the paper that we would like to focus the discussions and gather your input from. First of all, whether the areas that we have identified, of course, are the areas that we consider to be the relevant ones for the purposes of this review, and also then in more detail, what are your views on the specific questions in paper 5B? And this would be an introduction for our discussions for this meeting.
Open the floor.
Can I just check? 5B is effectively agenda reference 13.
Right. For the December, yeah.
Mariella, how important is the work that the FAF has been doing on 141 and fair value to the way in which you're shaping this review? Are you trying to keep parallel, express differently? How important is it to maintain the convergence?
Well, the scope was different to start with, so they have a more limited scope. They only focused the review on 141R. They didn't focus the review on 142, dealing with goodwill. We are undertaking a broader review because it includes also the amendments put to IS-36, IS-38. So our scope is a bit broader. But some of the main issues that they have identified in their review have also appeared in this first phase. For example, the definition of a business, or issues that constituents have encountered in relation to fair value measurement. So there are few matters that have appeared as well during this first phase here, but we are starting from different scopes as well. So we do have matters arising with non-amortization of goodwill that, of course, were not identified there. We have matters arising with a separate identification of intangibles from goodwill that, of course, is not appearing there.
It was a massive standard to put in place, and it was a massive effort on the part of both the FASB and the IASB to come to the same answer. It's hard for this board, I think, to quite understand how controversial it was, but it'd be right up there with the ones you're dealing with now.
Yeah. Yes. And so we should be careful.
Very careful.
Where we tread. Did you say something?
Well, I was just. I think what you have in 5B are the appropriate types of questions to go out and seek outreach. The FAF has completed a PIR on 141. As a result of that, the board has considered some of the recommendations, but we haven't completed that. We have added to our agenda, although we really have not devoted substantial resources to looking at clarifying the definition of a business. The reason we haven't devoted substantial resources is we are waiting until the completion of your PIR, recognizing that your PIR activities are substantially broader than what the FAF has done. We've also, through our private company council, recently the board endorsed a recommendation of the PCC to amortize goodwill for non-public companies in the U.S. We are currently engaging in research as to whether or not that philosophy or a different philosophy should be done for goodwill in the U.S. We have had a lot of observations by our stakeholders that there should not be a difference between public and private companies and how you account for goodwill. But we recognize that there are a substantial amount of resources provided to have a substantially converged, it's not an exactly converged solution on goodwill, but a substantially converged solution. And so we want to understand a few things before we move forward. One is some of the improvements that we made about a year and a half ago to what we call a step zero, but a threshold to get into the goodwill impairment test. Has that relieved some of the pressures and relieved some of the costs? We want to understand another cycle of rounds, and then understand what if we were to amortize goodwill, how would that be used by investors? Our initial reaction is that they likely would unwind the amortization in a non-GAAP metric. And so if that's the case, what could we do? So we're very interested in what you find out. I'm very happy to share anything that I could on the PIR that we did. I do expect there'll be future PIR activities on these types of things. I do recognize that I believe fair value is part of that. Okay, and I needed some research. And we have announced that one of the PIRs they're looking for is the 160 non-controlling interest.
Oh, yeah.
Is what? Sorry.
160 non-controlling interest, which is within the scope of your thing.
Might not be such a bad idea if we get our results and start to discuss it in the mm-hmm. here that you could join in.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Okay. Equal.
Okay, thank you. We appreciate the ISV decision to include the 2004 decision as well as 2008 amendment into the post-implementation review of standards of business combinations. We also appreciate that the question in the draft request for information includes section about non-amortization of goodwill and indefinite life of intangible assets. However, we feel that the question in the draft should be clarified so that it will invite comments on whether non-amortization of goodwill was found to be appropriate. Without prejudicing the outcome, I believe that this is the area that the ISB should invite specific comment, because we all know that it is one of the most controversial areas when the ISB developed IFRS 3. I would also like to note that ASBJ has been working on a research project in partnership with the EFRAG, Italian and Indian accounting standard setters, to investigate the source of problems as well as possible solutions. So we will be happy to share the project with the IASB so that our group work will be of help to progress the post-implementation review process. Thank you.
Liesl?
Thank you. In a way, you have set out the questions, but as you have a sort of catch-all in mind, you can say that's the scope, but with a catch-all, the scope might just as well be a little wider. In papers in September for the IFIS IC, I think, you had a longer list of questions that have come up, and in a way, we thought that this longer technical list would maybe help people better to find what they should maybe answer. You have, I think, debated appending something like that to this, and I think the paper, what we have now as 5B, might be a bit summary, or it might not trigger the mind of people in the way you could if you at least made the papers available somewhere. And I was meant to at least mention some, or one point particularly, that's contingent payments, earn out clauses and things like that, which supposedly have caused quite a bit of thought here and there when there were business combinations. And if you don't ask for it, you get it under other matters anyway.
Marielle, could you sort of describe what you think the document will look like? Because I didn't think this was what the public was going to see.
Yes. We have in paper 13, which is your paper 5B, briefly outline a very overall structure of what the request for information would look like. And we have suggested to have, of course, an introduction of the post-implementation review, background of IFRS 3 business combinations, explaining there what were the main changes and the rationale for those changes, the invitation to comment, which would be then these questions that you have seen here, and of course, to explain constituents about the next steps of the review. So that would be the structure.
Roger?
Just a couple of comments. I mean, I think it's a very good paper. It didn't have some things in, I suppose, I was expecting. But of course, you can get to those by the catch-all in section 9. One particular question would be the requirement to expense acquisition costs through the income statements of the year of acquisition, which I know quite a lot of people don't like, because then they can't hold management to account for those costs later on when they see how the business performs. So, but that's one example, and there are others. So I think perhaps having that longer list might help to spur people's memory.
Yeah. Well, so can I just, a little bit response to that. What the process is a two-step one, and we actually did a lot of outreach talking to auditing firms, preparers, users, and so on. And while acquisition costs was identified at the time business combinations came out as one of the controversial issues, I don't think you got any feedback at all on that. So the idea of the first round is to try and get a sense of what people are worried about. And when we hear nothing about a particular issue, I think we would, in the request for information, we're supposed to acknowledge, I think it is, the controversial issues at the time, but some of those have actually gone away. I think the contingent consideration is something we're aware of mainly through the IFRIC requests that we get. So we've got some, we understand some of those processes as well. And that's the tricky thing too. The longer the list, the greater the expectation you create in the minds of people that we're going to come out with this big, you know, we're going to change this and change that and so on. In fact, we have a pretty robust interpretations process anyway, and those issues come to us. The concern we would have is if we're getting lots and lots of issues about continued consideration, maybe we need to do something more fundamental with that issue. So we're a bit worried about creating expectation that we're going to change 50 things in this and then the fundamentals as well. But certainly, when we hear nothing about an issue, that might come up, but we didn't...
It's interesting because I have heard it fairly recently, but that's your research.
Yeah.
Secondly, obviously by the time you've done this, you've waited to hear what the FASB's other work is, you've deliberated. This is not going to be a very short-term issue, is it? I mean, this is going to be for the next agenda at the earliest. And there are a few issues around which people are concerned about, which I think probably the ISB would recognise could be improved. I suppose I'm concerned that those are all going to be pushed away because you're doing this post-implementation review into the long grass. One of those is this issue that if future deferred payments are dependent upon management remaining in the business, they're all treated as remuneration and therefore taken through the income statement, which actually some people quite like. It's a case of the income statement, it's added back in non-GAAP measures, and then you haven't got the goodwill anymore. I did think that was intended, and I'm wondering whether you couldn't do some sort of short-term improvements program in a more timely fashion to just solve some of these low-level issues.
And I think that is a possibility that we would definitely look at. The timing of this review, we'd expect to sort of be able to sort of complete this probably around the end of 2014, and in terms of publishing a feedback statement, sort of summarising everything we've heard through the review. And then the next step would be to look at those issues that have come out of the review and decide, which ones are are there broader scope issues, in which case they should go into the next agenda consultation 2015. Are there some narrower scope issues, which I think are perhaps some of the ones that perhaps you have in mind, that would be better off being addressed in the shorter term? And certainly the one that you mentioned in particular is one that obviously has come to the Interpretations Committee, and that we've identified as something that does need looking at in the shorter term. We just want to hear what we get in from this particular post-implementation review.
Yeah, because one thing that has happened is we tend to have a look at IAS 28, which is the equity method. There's a change, and there's another one and another one. And so rather than just quickly do that, if we find some other things come up in the review, we're better off actually having a bit of a package rather than endless. And Kevin will tell us about how expensive that process is in Australia, because they have to pay for every amendment we make to government to register it, so you'd rather have one batch, I think.
And?
Or less. None.
Thank you. Firstly, we generally agree with the questions that you raised in the paper, and I would like to share with you some of the preliminary views from the project team in my department. It's really a detailed and comprehensive list of questions that we do appreciate. The project team in my department, they have some additional concerns on the following three area. One is on the reverse acquisition. The second one is regarding to the how to accounting for the tax effect of the business combination. The third one is about the business combination under common control. If possible, their suggestion is, could you please add some questions regarding this area to your list of questions? That's only our preliminary view. Because of the limited time to make preparation, our project team, they will seek inputs from stakeholders in China to gather additional comments, and if possible, we can send you by email to follow up what they are thinking about it. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Linda?
Generally, I think you've identified kind of the major things that we're hearing in our jurisdiction. I would encourage you, with regard to step acquisitions, we have heard, and I experienced in my previous life applying that guidance, and there are some difficulties there. So if you want to be put in touch with people who can comment on that, I'm more than happy to help you do that. I echo Kevin's comments, first comments that he made with regard to the notion of the fair value measurements and what you do in that regard. The other thing that I'm aware of, and I sort of see in terms of some of the questions, but not directly, and they probably will come out in question 9, is regard to valuation methodologies. And there seems to be a growing belief within our jurisdiction, based on my conversations, that we still have a preference for valuation methodologies in different jurisdictions, as opposed to looking at the type of item you're valuing and applying the same methodology. So that may likely come out in question 9, not sure.
Can I just write on the fair value measurement one? That's an interesting issue, and maybe Rusty can help me, but I read the review from the FAF in particular. What I'm quite keen to do is to not, and we discussed this at the AOE, I think at the AOSSG a little bit as well, is to not drag too many things into the BizCom project, because I agree fair value is very important. It happened to be that we introduced the standard at about the same time, and we changed the definition of fair value from an exchange transaction to an exit value, and gave a couple of hundred pages of requirements that went with it, and it's clearly related. But this is about the business combinations, and if we, to give you another parallel, we've changed the definition of control as well in IFRS 10, but I don't really want to review IFRS 10 yet, and so on. And if we're not careful, we'll end up dragging all these things in. Now, my impression or interpretation of the FAF review is that a lot of people came back and said fair value caused difficulties, particularly in a BizCom, because they came out at the same time. And I read three things into that. One is, because there was all this new methodology given in the standard, then people all of a sudden thought much more about these fair values and were a bit troubled by it. The PCOAB got quite aggressive at the time, and so people were getting 2 or 3 valuations and really putting a lot of effort in, so they were doing a lot more than they had previously. And we also hit the financial crisis, and so the alternative use was far more prevalent, particularly for property, plant and equipment and things like that, than it might otherwise have been. So when we did a whole lot of field testing on fair value and the definitions before we actually put BizCom out, we had a very interesting exercise where people spent hundreds of hours valuing a company for us and concluded, with all the individual items, not a single one would change its fair value based on what we anticipated the new fair value would be. Except for one company said for one asset they thought it might have a different alternative use, but they needed more information. But I think that when the financial crisis hit, basically, alternative use was much more prevalent than thought otherwise. And the difficulty is that really puts a real, if you take all of those fair value issues and the PCOAB and so on, and load them onto BizCom, it's not the business combination standard that's the issue, it's actually those other factors. And we are trying as much as we can to isolate some of those things there as well. And in a similar manner, you've got to be careful in a review that you don't push people in a particular direction. But it's like, we know the definition of a business is a major issue. But on the other hand, we've actually asked the question, is there a difference between acquiring a group of assets or acquiring a group of assets, you look at that and say, well, I think it's a business. There are 3 accounting differences in there. Mm-hmm. Are there actually economic differences there, or should we have the same accounting? You remove the arbitrage opportunity because of the differences, and then the definition of a business doesn't matter anymore. So we're trying to get people to step back a little bit, because it's come up a few times where this was a hugely controversial standard to put in place. It seems intuitively to be working reasonably well. Do we really want to go back and throw it out? Or are we trying to make some improvements to the standard, or at least review and learn something from the process as well? So it's a very tricky thing, because the first two reviews we did, the first review we did on operating segments was not as fundamental looking as this one. So
I think the way Alan described is accurate, but I actually heard you say something a little, just an additional point, which is that because there is a lack, at least in the U.S. and I think maybe in Canada, of consistently established policies and methodologies for valuation professionals, you get different fair value estimates for the same things. And so we've seen that in the U.S. We've seen recently where our private company counsel had issued a proposal that certain intangible assets would not need to be valued. And it was clear in the comment letters from the valuation professionals that even though the accounting would no longer require one to recognize this, it would not reduce the costs. Because in order to determine the total cost of the other recognized intangible assets, you had to value individually the unrecognized intangible assets. So it was a little ironic that even though we would no longer make one account for it, it would not reduce the cost. And so that gets to a different infrastructural issue about what role do valuation standards, if at all, play in developing accounting standards.
So are they reliable estimates, do you think?
David's going to call you.
François?
Yeah, just to say that we last discussed, I mean, this proposal for the request for information last week, and it's welcomed by the Forum of Standard Setters in Europe as covering the issues that have to be covered. They appreciate the thoroughness in which everything has been prepared, and they also support the recommendation that Lisa made. I understand what you say, Alan, about trying to do things in good order. And I think what you say more particularly applies to what you intend to be doing with the results of the post-implementation review. You cannot help, and I think you should not expect to prevent a more complete picture to come out of this post-implementation review, even if there is an interaction among standards. Because these are good input to collect, to understand, and then to determine appropriate action. So I very much understand and support the orderly manner in which you think that things should be handled and looked at. But the idea should not be to consider that a certain number of comments, because they relate more to IFRS 13 or another standard, would best not be included in the feedback statement. Because I think that the participation of constituents in this kind of effort is also an effort and a cost, and there are lessons to be learned on how to improve, and that doesn't mean that there is an emergency, and that doesn't mean that everything has to be considered at the same time, but I would really recommend that the feedback statement is as comprehensive as possible, considering the input received.
I think that's an excellent point, and because my point is basically we're trying to isolate the business combination issues, and if one of the related issues is some difficulties with the fair value measurement standard, then that should be something that comes out of the review and is highlighted. In a similar manner, when you look at amortization versus impairment, perhaps it's the impairment model that's not working particularly well, and there could be some feedback on that, because there are two schools of thought here. There's a fundamental one, and I know Japan in particular would prefer to have an amortization model. But on the other hand, maybe if the impairment model and the way we allocate to cash generating units was changed, we might have a more responsive impairment test, for example. So those are the types of issues that I think would come out of that. And quite right, in terms of a review itself and report, should point to related issues. And the trouble with accounting is it's debits and credits, everything's related. So you can't isolate everything. But you can at least try and, as much about the business combination, then we can focus more on the IFRS 13. Because that's, I can't, don't know what the pipeline is, but it must be about 18 months away from a review of that anyway. So you think about the timing of this next year, and then won't be too far off starting that process.
It should be second half of 2015 would be the post-implementation review of IFRS 13 would start.
So there's a lead in, that's all.
Clemens?
Thank you. Thank you, Hans. The only other questions that I would like to add from one of our constituents in the region is the question of what kind of transactions could be made to the scoping of this business combination that could be added to part one of the RFI. That's the only other things that I'd like to mention. Thank you.
Roger?
I'm not sure that I'd say the standard was working particularly well, given the number of non-GAAP adjustments that are made in people's financial statements to back the effects out. But I do agree it's not that urgent, because people do make these non-GAAP adjustments, and users tend to focus on the adjusted numbers. But I think one issue is that at the time the standard came in, it was rather pushing the envelope on the conceptual framework. It sort of took some of the concepts in a direction which I think were out inconsistent with the previous framework. The question is, I suppose, will they be consistent with where you end up with the new conceptual framework? So I think probably there's no point changing, if you do change anything fundamental, until you've concluded your deliberations on the new conceptual framework.
Do you have some examples?
Well, I can point to a letter issued by my predecessor as chairman of the ASB, which I thought was extremely good, actually. And
very good.
I'll send it to you.
I have grave doubts about the.
Ian.
Mariella, you may have come across this sort of information, but after I left the ISB and went back into practice, I was basically doing transactions type work, large-scale acquisitions. And one of the pieces of information that was available within my firm, and I think they may have published it externally from time to time, was a breakdown of purchase prices versus the various types of intangibles and identifiable assets versus unidentifiable assets, industry by industry, and over time. And it was really very revealing. I think Russ's point about the variation in valuation methodologies is undoubtedly right. And you could see, period by period, that shifting. The only reservation that you need to bear in mind if you get those statistics and look at them is that the difference between the purchase price and identifiable assets changes over time for other reasons besides valuation. Sometimes it costs you more to buy the same assets at a different period. So it's a little bit confounding when you see the percentage. But in my context of working for acquirers, those sorts of numbers were invaluable because we modelled the acquiree from them. Competitive acquisitions or unfriendly acquisitions, you have to work out what you can from what you've got. So there is a lot of data around like that. I'm not sure how accessible, but I would go looking for it if I were you.
Thank you very much.
And I very much appreciate what Alan said about trying to position this versus the other standards. There is, and Michael will be aware of this, there was a huge issue in three around pick a purchaser. If we were going to kill pooling, and you had something that people would assert was a true merger, nevertheless, the attitude was you still have to pick a purchaser. You read back on the document now, as I'm sure Michael and his team have been doing, and then read 10, and you more than have to read between the lines to see how those two documents now articulate. So the poster child, when we were debating pick a purchaser, were roll-ups. And I think medical practitioners in the US and others, where you might have 10 practitioners come together, they're all equal, and you form a business. In the ISB's mind at that time, you had to pick one of those. Bad luck, you couldn't do a pooling on it. Have a look now and see how you find the literature covering that sort of issue. We've referred stable securities to Michael, but that's just one variation of this issue. Two other areas that were subtle, well, one was subtle and the other one was explicit, partial versus full goodwill. I think both boards intellectually thought full goodwill was the way to go, but it was a step too far at the time. So I would have thought some research around who's done partial, who's done full, and implications of that would be interesting. The other one that I would regard as subtle, and I don't want to be insulting towards the US, but
it's okay.
I might make an exception on this one.
Okay, Kevin.
you know, there's been different mentalities around the world towards consolidation, and they ripple below the surface. They don't actually get into the literature. The philosophy in the US of having an investment in a controlled entity, or when that investment becomes a controlling situation, is that your investment morphs into the underlying assets and liabilities. A transaction or event has happened to take your focus away from the investment to the underlying assets and liabilities. Many other parts of the world with separate financial statements had a completely different philosophy. In the separate financial statements, you showed the investor perspective, and in the consolidated accounts, you showed the economic entity perspective. Now, that may seem like a fairly subtle difference, but in the economic entity model, there's no reason why you would get a gain or loss on an acquisition. Whereas in the morphing model, you had to do something to get the investment up to the fair value at the time of acquisition. So you have the so-called deathbed gains and losses. Now, you won't find that written out anywhere, I don't think, but it's quite a different approach. And I know different economies have been affected differently on that. You know, it reaches into various things. Yeah, and there's no doubt in practice that this standard, we operate with new standards almost in the mentality of when it's out, people are going to comply with it. But in our heart, we know there's an educational period. This one required quite a period of settling down. I had many battles with valuers within my firm trying to get them to understand fair value and not to be transposing their valuation models that they were used to. And that took a while. So the early numbers you'll see from when three came into the later numbers, I think there's an educational phase going on there.
Kim?
Thanks, Hans. Well, yeah, we also welcome the post-implementation review. Just to add to a couple of points that have already been made, and I acknowledge that you don't want to deal with a whole lot of other aspects, but I think that if you're going to touch on the requirement to fair value at the date of acquisition, will you also consider looking at the interaction with other standards on day two? And it's interesting, we've had a situation come up involving IAS 37, and again, it could also just be a case of different interpretations of the application of IAS 37, but if on day one you need to recognize, let's say, an environmental rehabilitation liability or an asset retirement obligation or whatever at fair value, I guess typically the way a lot of us have applied IAS 37 is then looking at what the entity is going to cost, the entity will incur to settle. And if the entity could do it in-house, etc., you don't have the issue of, I guess, the profit margin, the risk margin, you don't have all of those things, whereas in the fair value, well, it's this exit price. So some of the questions that have come up is to say, well, okay, the date of acquisition, you've got to book this liability at fair value, and then day two, do you all of a sudden say, well, I can settle this for a lot less by sort of fulfilling the obligation? And again, it goes back to, well, is that the correct application? So there have been a couple of, I guess, sort of almost the day two interactions of what do you do once you've now done your business combination accounting. So that might be something that, you know, could be addressed as well. And then I don't know if this is maybe then pushing the boundary a little bit too far, but well, NCI puts be considered, and I suppose then the issue around, you know, the attribution subsequently depending upon the nature of those NCI puts, or is that a little bit out of the scope?
It's probably out of the scope. NCI puts, though, that's not out of the, not being thrown in the long grass. That's it's been backwards and forwards since 2006 to the Interpretations Committee, because I wrote a paper for it and somebody popped on my desk the other day. So it has been around a long time, and we've been every time you do a short-term fix, these short-term things take forever. We've decided to do it as part of liabilities equity, and so the project manager is doing a more fundamental look at that, because we're the liabilities equity standards level project is running in parallel with conceptual framework, because it's good in a couple of perspectives. You can throw some examples at the framework to make sure you're getting intuitive answers, and also means that if we get the framework sorted, we're actually ready to go with the standards level as well. So that we decided it would be better off doing it properly, because what we've tended to do is we've chipped away and undermined and created exception after exception to IS 32, and we think we should be do something better than that.
Because it's not just the classification of the, you know, whether or not it's equity or is it a liability, but it's also then the attribution of the net profits, and there certainly is diversity in practice there regarding that. So, okay, that's great. Thank you.
Any other comments or questions?
I just think, I mean, this has been really interesting, I think, but it leaves us with the big question of what do we want to do with post-implementation reviews? You know, how broad do we want them to be? What actions do we want to take? You know, do we want to turn three upside down if everybody comes? We want to go back to amortizing goodwill? How does it affect other standards, and then convergence? How we deal with that. So,
but yeah, what I also find a little bit puzzling about this process is that we are reviewing all the new standards, whereas the big problems are with the old standards.
But we have more than once said that post-implementation review should take place also for other standards, because basically, if you identify that there are difficulties in practice, then you can understand. Undertake a review and learn from it for the next agenda consultation. So I don't think anything has prevented you from.
It's embarrassing because I reread the handbook 2 days ago on that particular issue, and it actually says that we can, as well as the new ones we automatically look at after 2 to 3 years, we should, post-implementation review should also be undertaken if we identify a deficiency or so on, or people come to us. So
one does not exclude the other.
No, just we haven't done one yet.
But I do think our attitude should be that it being a recent standard, you are mainly looking for unintended consequences and evident practical problems, rather than a fundamental review of the core of a standard.
And this is only our second one, so maybe we need to do this one, and this is obviously going to be a very difficult one, and then maybe step back and say, is this the right process? Are we achieving what we want to? What do we want to achieve, and are we achieving it? And, you know, but I think this. I don't envy our poor team tomorrow.
I think it's also worth noting that, of course, when we are taking on a new project onto the agenda, we start off with the research phase and discussion papers, and that covers some of the sort of similar sort of ground, looking at what are the issues, what are the practical, what are the financial reporting needs and the issues that are, and the needs that are not being met in terms of those projects, those areas, before then moving on to developing exposure drafts. So I could see a sort of an overlap in a way, you know, should we do a post-implementation review of an old standard, or should we do a research project that's looking at the same area?
One comment I'd make, and it's far too early for it really to resonate too much, but this form of accounting is price sensitive. So you change the method of acquisition accounting, you will actually change, quite possibly change cash flows, and you will change prices. So, you know, when you get to a shift in this standard, you'll find that transactions that are out in the field are watching like hawks what you're doing. And so you've got to be careful, I think, not to create uncertainties if there aren't real uncertainties to deal with.
Okay. All right, I think that brings us to the end of this discussion. Mariela?
I would just like to mention a couple of matters before finishing.
Of course.
I have heard some topics or specific matters that concerns your jurisdiction, such as, for example, reverse acquisitions, tax effects, well, which is reverse acquisitions also linked to identifying the acquirer. Probably also Kevin's remark about the entity perspective, investor's perspective is also related to separate financial statements. So what I wanted to tell you, and you have of course noticed already, is that paper 5A of your handout included also other matters such as contingent consideration, consideration versus compensation, tax effects, separate financial statements, that all of those matters were considered and were assigned a medium degree of relevance. And we find it quite hard to put all of those matters in to be reflected, all of those matters in specific questions. That would have been a very unoperational and ineffective way of asking constituents for their participation as well. So what we thought is to a way to make sure that those matters were also included in the request is to have question 9, which is a question that is open and aims to ensure completeness. We acknowledge that those matters are also relevant, but we could not include in the request for information 20 questions. So we have it's a compromise basically. And the second thing that I wanted to say is that we aim to publish the request for information by the end of January next year.
Okay, thank you, Mariela.